tuning in to a Very Suspect podcast. Here's Lewis and Glenn.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of A Very Suspect podcast. And with me is my musical guru, Glenn.
Hello.
And I am Lewis. And today we're going to talk about a true star of metal and of our childhood. And and it's somebody that's working still and has just released an album.
The King of Shock Rock.
The King of Shock Rock. Maybe not the originator, but the biggest.
No.
Of the shock rock gods, other than, you know, Kiss. But I mean, this guy you graduated to after you discovered Kiss, as far
sure.
as I'm concerned. And that is Alice Cooper.
And I think also that depends on your age too, because obviously older listeners knew of Alice before they probably knew of Kiss records.
That's true. That's
so
true.
It depends
yeah.
on your age, I think. You know,
yeah, you're absolutely right. And
yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you discovered Alice Cooper?
Well, it was probably around 77 and 78 when I really started to pay attention, and it was with a compilation record, actually, if I recall. I did not start off with a studio album, per se. I started off with that very first Greatest Hits collection. You know,
the
cover, the gangster kind of thing and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was, I think, the very first piece of Alice Cooper vinyl I owned.
That's a good start.
Yeah, it was a good start because it was just sort of like, here's like 10 or 12, whatever it was, good songs from each of the records up to that point that represented the radio songs and things like that. And so that's kind of, I know, I'm no doubt I heard some of the stuff on the radio, and that's what made me go for that because I recognized titles like, a lot of those songs are on this record, so this is a good place to start. And, you know, and when you're 10, 11, something like that, that's kind of the way you start with a good sampler, you know.
True.
And then if you like that, then you delve deeper, and that's what happened. I'm sure that the record I bought after that was Welcome to My Nightmare.
Yeah, probably. That was my first album of theirs.
Yeah,
or
definitely.
Of his, I should say.
Yep, that was the way to do it at
yeah.
that time period when you're of a certain age. And, you know, and he was getting a lot of TV exposure and things like that by the time 1977 came around, so it was easier to be aware of what this guy was up to and what his thing was, whereas... You know, prior to Welcome to My Nightmare, I was way too young to be aware, really, of, you know, of albums like Love It to Death and Killer at the time because I was 5, 6, you know what I mean?
So oh, yeah.
I wasn't the target audience for that at that point in time. But, you know, once you get to, like, 1977 and I was 10, all of a sudden it becomes more like, okay, I've seen this guy on TV, I see these ads in the rock magazines, I got to check this out.
Right.
And then hearing certain songs on the radio, too, of course, so...
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, that's how I got started with Alice. Yeah.
That's cool.
Definitely.
Yeah, so, I think the first time that I saw him, there was a documentary series on television called All You Need Is Love. And I think it was a British produced television series. And it was the history of pop music.
I remember
and,
that one.
Yeah, do you? Yeah. And it was, I guess, because I'd heard that Kiss was going to be on the final episode, which was, I think it was titled The New Direction. They had Alice Cooper performing, and of course they had Kiss and they had Bowie and stuff, but I remember watching Alice going, holy crap, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and then going out and buying Welcome to My Nightmare. Yeah.
I mean, a 10-year-old boy is going to look at, you know, some of that live footage of guillotines and hangings and be like, wow.
Yeah.
It's definitely, it's got all the ingredients to entice you. And then the sound of the music on top of that, too. So, especially
yeah.
if you're predisposed to liking the hard rock sounds of the era, you're going to be like, that's kind of cool. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like we said before, this is a guy that's still putting out music. And this podcast is pretty timely of us to record because he's just released another album.
Mm-hmm. Which is his 28th studio album to date.
Pretty crazy, eh?
Yep, 28 studio albums. Actually, there's probably 30 studio albums if you consider the two side projects, The Hollywood Vampires, that he did with Joe Perry and Johnny Depp. Those, they would make it an even 30 studio recordings since the beginning of his career. Albums.
Wow.
No. You know, when you get into all the other little things on the side, too, live recordings and everything else like that, then it's just a ridiculous amount of albums. But yeah, 28 studio albums as Alice Cooper or the Alice Cooper Group, like in the original incarnation, and then the two, you know, albums with the Hollywood Vampires, but still 30 studio recordings from the beginning till the present. You know.
Pretty amazing, eh?
So we'll start off with the new one.
Yeah,
that, right?
Yeah. Let's tackle that. Yeah, the new one is called Detroit Stories,
mm-hmm.
or
just
Detroit.
Came out at the end of February.
Yeah,
and it's sort of a concept album of sorts. Starting back a couple of years ago, he did an EP called Breadcrumbs, which was like 5 or 6 song EP, and it was sort of like a taster of this concept that he was going to do of basically honoring the history of Detroit, which of course is his birthplace, even though he spent a lot of his younger years in Phoenix, Arizona, when his parents moved him there. Mm-hmm. When he was in his early teens, apparently he had various health issues that they thought would be better served by going to a place like Arizona with drier air. I think asthma and things like that were a lot of problems for him when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, later in life, he would use asthma as an excuse for various certain things, which we'll get to later on in the podcast. But, so asthma, I guess, was a concern at one point in his life. It probably hasn't really been an overwhelming concern to the bulk of his life, but I guess it was at that point, which led to the move from Michigan to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, Detroit kind of played a big part in breaking Alice Cooper out as a musical performer, because they weren't doing so well in California, which we'll get to in a bit. Mm-hmm. But Detroit is where it really started to take off, with the third album, Love It to Death. Mm-hmm. So Detroit is almost like this spiritual home, even though it might not have been the birthplace of the actual band.
No. It's funny that Detroit and Toronto are the two big cities in terms of Cooper's career.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll get to some of that too as we go on. But as far as Detroit's stories is concerned, it reads as sort of like a love letter, a tribute, you could say, to Detroit. Essentially, he does a lot of songs that were done by others.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the songs have Detroit origins, some not. The album starts off with a cover of Lou Reed or Velvet Underground's Rock and Roll, which of course has nothing to do with New York City in terms of origin, but has a lot to do with New York City in terms of Detroit, I should say. I'm being confused now. Has more to do with Detroit because of the fact that Mitch Ryder, in his post Detroit Wheels group, which was just simply called Detroit, actually recorded Lou Reed's Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
And so Alice is doing a version based more on the Mitch Ryder Detroit version than the Lou Reed Velvet Underground version.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's similarities between both versions. Although I got to say that I think the Mitch Ryder Detroit version is actually a much harder hitting version than Alice's version. Yeah, so, and it has the same drummer on it, too. He actually used the same guy that Mitch Ryder was using, Johnny D.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Detroit people on Detroit Stories, the new album. I mean, he's got Mark Farner from Grand Funk on it. He's got Wayne Kramer on a lot of it. I mean, there's different people show up who have Detroit histories. Even in more modern era bands, there was a band called Outrageous Cherry, and they do an Outrageous Cherry cover on there, and the guitarist from Outrageous Cherry even plays on another song on the record. So there's a lot of different elements of Detroit. Now, 2 years ago when they put out this EP called Breadcrumbs, there was some of the same tracks that show up on the album, but some songs that didn't. Like, for instance, on the EP, there's a cover of Suzy Quatro's Your Mama Won't Like Me, which they left off the record, as well as a song by the Dirt Bombs called Chains of Love, which they left off this record, and a cover of Devil with a Blue Dress On, which is also not on the album. So the EP was sort of like, this is what we're going to do when we flesh this thing out to a full album. And we'll throw some different songs on it. Like, for instance, there's other covers on this. On the Detroit Stories album, there's a cover of East Side Story, which was an early Bob Seger solo tune.
Mm-hmm.
In the earliest days of Bob Seger before the hits came. And that's actually one of the better covers, I think, on the Alice Cooper record.
Mm-hmm.
It's a faithful version, but it's really well done. But as far as the original material on Detroit Stories, it's a mixed bag. I mean, there are certain songs where he's trying to pay tribute to aspects of Detroit's musical history. So there's one track that has more of a blues vibe to it.
Yeah.
There's another track that has more of a Motown vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
And those ones I find are less successful.
I found that too, yeah.
There are other songs on the record that have more of a blues rock feel or a Motown-y vibe, including with female backup vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those songs, I mean, they're okay. I can see why he's doing them, because they fit into the whole story of the Detroit's different sounds. But they're not exactly the high points of the record. I mean,
no.
For me, on this record, the things that work best are just sort of Alice doing what you expect him to do. Like, his version of MC5 Sister Anne is played very straight.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't as good as the MC5 version, but it's played very straight, you know, and you'd hope it would be somewhat decent, the guitar part, since it's Wayne Kramer playing the guitar parts on it.
Right, yeah.
But it still feels a little different. I think the record works best with some of the more straight-up aggressive songs that could have been on any of Ellis's last few records.
Yeah, I think so, too. And there's even elements of classic Ellis Cooper, like the the scary type stuff.
To me, the record worked best with the retake of their song Detroit City, which was originally a song that Ellis put on his Eyes of Ellis Cooper record back in 2003, also with Wayne Kramer playing on that. This version has some different changes in the verses and some of the lines in the songs and everything, but basically the arrangement of the music is the same. And so I thought that was an effective song. I think the record should have opened with that. That would have made more sense to me, but whatever. I think the highlight of the record for me is a song called Social Debris, which is one of two songs that reunite the what's left of the original Alice Cooper group, which he's been doing for the last few years now on his records. There's always a few tracks where he gets the remaining original band together. As far as the original band is concerned, the only one still not live, or there's just the only one that's not alive, is Glenn Buxton.
Right.
He died quite a long time ago. But Michael Bruce, Dennis Dunaway, and Neil Smith are still around. So ever since the Welcome to My Nightmare record, Welcome to My Nightmare Volume 2, you could say, from not too many years ago, he's been playing with those guys, usually on a couple to three songs on these albums. And that, I think those some of those are the highlights of the records in some cases. Not in all cases, but definitely they've been some of the stronger songs. And that's the case on this. Social Debris is one of them.
Yeah, Social Debris is a great song. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the highlights of the record. I won't plug in to that machine. I hate the sound. I hate that scene. I sure ain't hip. I sure can't hop. I lost the script. I lost the plot. There's spies are everywhere. I feel them hiding there. On my face, in my hair. I just can't cope. With all this disease, it's pushing down, 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 down on me. Look at me, what you see? It's social debris. The other song that the original band plays on is an odd song, but I can see why they would be on it too, because the Alice Cooper group in the original days always did these kind of oddball songs, but there's a song called I Hate You, which seems to be a listing of negative things that people have said about Alice Cooper over the years, and sort of all thrown into a song about, you know, your nose is crooked and you're this and you're that and you're whatever, you know, all these kind of stupid obnoxious remarks. And, you know, so that was kind of amusing. There's a song called Go Man Go, which is kind of like a straight-up fast-paced, you know, almost like a garage punk tune in some ways, and I thought that was pretty solid. A song called Hail Mary is pretty solid original. There was an original called Shut Up and Rock, which is really kind of stupid, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of dumb. It's dumb
it's
rock
kind of
and roll.
It's dumb as hell,
yeah.
But it makes sense, and I guess it ties into his beliefs about, you know, people ranting on about their politics and in music, because Alice has some pretty, you know, Well, we'll get into that, but he's definitely got some, he's got some, you know, things that you really wouldn't associate with Alice Cooper attached to his belief system. And so Shut Up and Rock, I guess, is an interesting way of addressing that even too. Like, you know, these people don't need to tell you everything about their beliefs on things. Just do your thing. And so Shut Up and Rock is definitely a song about that. And, and I thought that was a decent one too. So yeah, I mean, it's a long record. There's 15 songs on it. It probably doesn't need 15. It could probably get by with 10, 11, 12, maybe maximum, you know, and lose a few things. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's one of the best things he's done in the last 10 years. Yeah, I think there's definitely better records in the last 10 years and definitely way better records in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we'll get into that, obviously. But, yeah, you know, I mean, it's still an Alice Cooper record. And, I mean, the dude is now 73 years old. You know what I mean?
And so, still rocking,
Yeah, it's like, you expect somewhat diminishing returns as time goes on with any sort of artist, you know, but it's still pretty solid. So, you know, like there's still things to recommend about, you know, that album. I don't think it's his best in the last 20 years at all, far from it, but, you know, it still has its moments, definitely.
Definitely.
So, should we just backtrack to the beginning now?
Sure, let's start.
Okay, well, prior to the Alice Cooper group being together, he had another group. He had another group under a couple different guises, but essentially it was the Alice Cooper group, even at that point in time.
It was.
Back to 1966.
And this is back when they were in, this is back when they were in high school.
And in high school, I mean, it was originally, jokingly, it was called, they were called the Earwigs as a Beatles reference. But when they actually got serious about, you know, trying to really learn how to play and even write a few songs, they changed the name of the band to The Spiders. And they released two singles between 66 and 67. And the first one was just covers and things like that. But the second one actually does contain what is one of the, you know, American garage punk classics of that time period. It's a song called Don't Blow Your Mind. And that was pretty cool.
One day I'd find the game. Well, now you know they're not the same. I've tried to take me for a ride. Now all you did is suicide. We're two of a kind. Take what you can find. But don't blow your mind away.
So when they recorded that, they were basically intact as the way they were on the first Alice Cooper record. The only thing was the drummer. They had a guy named John Spear at that point, who then left after the Don't Blow Your Mind single, and then they brought in Neil Smith. So at that point, that's when it really became the Alice Cooper group that it stayed for all those prime years of the late 60s to the mid-70s. But yeah, they were briefly called the Naz as well, and they put out one single during that time, and then they found out about Todd Rundgren having a group called the Naz, and they abandoned the Naz.
They abandoned the Naz, yeah.
Yeah, and the Naz, you know, put out one single, and that was the first indication on the B-side of that single that they were going to develop a sound that was going to be very different than what the Spiders sounded like, because there was a song called Lay Down and Die Goodbye, which was on the B-side of that single.
I'm praying my final arm for the people who yet must die, for the liars and the robbers and the cheating crimes who tortured the dead few times. Well, I've written, oh, to mother, being ran from my tears. I said, Mama, Mama, please tell me why you brought me here. Well, I'll hang on another minute, but really I had to go. If you ever want to see me again, you know what you can do.
And that was a great song. That song definitely kind of paved the way for the sound that Alice Cooper would develop as the albums would continue on from there. And eventually they even re-recorded that song on their second album, Easy Action. But it was a long, drawn-out, 7-plus-minute version, whereas the version on the single is not even 3 minutes. And I thought that was the more effective version, honestly. But, yeah, so, I mean, that's the beginning, basically, of the Alice Cooper Group. And and Toronto fits into the really early days of that as well, because one of their first big concerts outside of the States was in Toronto on September 13, 1969. You know which one I'm referring to?
I am. I mean, I do.
Yeah, there you go.
And do you want to talk about that? What was that called?
The Toronto Rock and Roll
Toronto
Revival.
Toronto Rock and Roll, yeah. And they were going on before John Lennon.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the band lineup for that entire show is very, very impressive.
Yeah, but we should talk about just briefly, like, they went from playing in high school and stuff and driving to Los Angeles and relocating to Los Angeles. And, of course, you know, their style was not the exactly the Los Angeles free love hippie type of thing.
No,
and
no.
They met up with Shep Gordon?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
well, I don't know how they met up Shep with how early into the LA stay they met up with Shep Gordon. I don't think it was right at the very beginning because – you know, it seems like the Frank Zappa connection was the earliest connection.
Yeah, but didn't Gordon get him that that audition?
It's
with
possible.
Frank Zappa? That's what I've read. And
yeah,
then
you might be right.
Yeah, and Zappa said to come over and, you know, perform for him at 7 o'clock. And you know, famously, they showed up at 7 in the morning and started playing their noise, basically.
Exactly.
And he signed them for 3 albums. Yeah,
although
but
they only did two,
and they were, you know, the albums didn't really go anywhere, and it was a different beast. They were more, I don't know, almost experimental and noise based, and you know,
it was very much in line with some of the more freaked out elements of psychedelic music of that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, it was not the sound that they would develop on Love It to Death, which was more streamlined, more classic hard rock structure. You know, the first two albums, especially the first one, Prettiest for You was the first. And the first one definitely is the one that has the most experimental elements to it.
It does, yeah.
It's interesting, though, that one of the songs on that record that was one of the better songs would eventually be taken and attempted again from the second shot, which was the song Reflected, eventually became the song Elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they basically took elements of that song and found a way to make something more commercial out of it. Although that song as Reflected even does show a more commercial element. There's a couple other songs too. There's a song called Living, which has a more of a standard style that they would run with later on, but for the most part a lot of the record is quirky and odd, and frankly I think one of the best songs got left off the record.
Which one?
There's they had done some recording, different sessions around that time period, and some of the things didn't quite make it at the time because they were in rougher demo form, but then they would flesh them out later. An example was a song called Nobody Likes Me, which actually saw released until a box that came out like decades after the fact. I think it was called I can't even remember now. There was a box set that Rhino put out that was a 4-CD set, and it was probably the first unveiling of that song in its studio form. And it's I don't know why it didn't make the record or even make the follow-up album, Easy Action, because it really does kind of, you know, bring upon the sense of humor that you would find throughout Alice Cooper's earlier recordings once they started to develop their more standard sound that people know, you know, of them. You know, like the first two albums, not really there. The second album, Easy Action, has a couple of moments. There's a song called, the first song of the album, Mr. and Misdemeanor, definitely paves the way to the sound of Love It to Death.
Mm-hmm.
But and Refrigerator Heaven even has elements of that, too. So they're beginning to get a little bit of what would come together as their main sound by the third album. But Love It to Death was like a whole different animal.
It was, yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like way more streamlined. It was way more easier for people to follow. It, you know, it was beginning to add elements of the horror kind of content, which really wasn't there on the other two records.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it definitely... I mean, it's not like a horror record in the same way that, you know, Welcome to My Nightmare is more of a thematic horror piece. I mean, obviously the Ballad of Dwight Fry and Love It to Death has those elements for sure.
for more. Held up in an intensive care ward, lying on the floor. I was gone for all those days, but I was not all alone. I made friends with a lot of people in the danger zone.
Songs like Caught in a Dream and Long Way to Go and things like that, and Be My Lover, they're not like that at all. You know, mm-hmm. They're just short, 3-minute, catchy hard rock songs. You know, but,
yeah,
they got a bit of a swagger to them of like the Stones and some of the elements and everything too. There's definitely a lot of that to some of the guitar work, but yeah, you know, it's very much more accessible than the first two albums.
Yeah, it really is.
Harder listens, even for the most rabid Alice Cooper fan, unless they have an appreciation for the more the out there elements. You know, the records, they're not very strong hook wise.
Mm-hmm.
Those records, but
yeah. And we should just talk briefly about the look, because you know,
the look was definitely different too.
Started you know, kind of early once they met up with, I guess, the all female band, the GTOs. Mm-hmm. Who were another band that was signed to Zappa, and they were just seemingly always around.
Yeah.
And they really like to dress up with all kinds of, you know, thrift store type of stuff, boas and everything. And
sure.
they were, you know, for all accounts, really responsible for dressing them up in terms of like almost like a West Coast New York Dolls type of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Yeah. And then the personality of Alice Cooper and his look with the makeup and everything.
Yeah, and he had different color hair back in those earlier days, knowing too. It wasn't quite the look that he would develop by Love It to Death. It was definitely more colorful, flamboyant, out there.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't have the horror element to it at all.
They were
more likely to be on stage wearing silver. You know, everything would be glittery in that sense than the look they would have developed later on.
Yeah, their thing was shocking as well, but shocking in terms of, you know, the androgynous aspect of,
sure.
of the cross-dressing and stuff, as opposed to the horror and antisocial type of stuff.
Yeah, it was meant to be more gender-bending weirdness and everything, too. So,
mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, the horror thing kind of started to... Well, that was easier to market, I think, too. And it would be something that could appeal to more people. especially to teenage lunkheads, you know, who are going to probably be way more into guillotines and black leather and that kind of thing than, you know, the more gender-bending elements. And also just to mention the music, too, which is not as accessible to the average teenage lunkhead as, you know, Love It to Death, Killer, Schools Out, Billion Dollar Babies, all that kind of stuff was.
Yeah,
that was very accessible to teenage morons in America.
But I think that they had an element of, you know, I mean, they obviously like genre stuff very early on, because even calling their band the Spiders still in high school kind of indicates that to me, although I might be projecting that, but I don't know. It seems like they were into that stuff.
No, I mean, they were definitely into all this kind of stuff, sure. And I mean, I don't think necessarily the audience had to be into this stuff to be interested in those records of that time too, Love It to Death through like Billion Dollar Babies. I think you just had to, they had to think it was cool, you know,
and
the guy with a guillotine on stage and people being hung and things like that, they thought that was cool, you know.
Yeah.
And the music was accessible enough that kind of teenage idiot could embrace it. You know, those same people wouldn't have embraced Pretties for You or Easy Action. They would listen to him and said, what is this shit?
Yeah.
You know, it was aimed at a different audience. And obviously it was a non-audience, because as Alice talks about that time, you know, people would walk out of them all the time when they'd play in clubs. People would just be like, this is garbage, and just leave. You know, they were known as the band that could drive everybody out of a venue in L.A. at that time. So, I mean, I think it tells you something, that the music was not going to appeal to many people. Zappa only was interested because he thought it was unappealing for the most part. Couldn't figure out what the hell they were doing, but he thought, if they're going to do something this weird, hey, why not? I'll put it out.
Exactly. Yeah, they were going nowhere in Los Angeles. And, like, I think it was even Alice that said that, you know, the whole scene was just not their scene. They said everybody out there, all the audience was all on psychedelics, and you know, they were much more of a beer drinking band, you know, like they went off and traveled to Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they thought the peacenicky aspect of a lot of the LA crowd, the hippies and you know, post sort of psychedelic kind of thing, just didn't appreciate the vibe. I thought it was just downer, man. You know, you guys have some bad vibes.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it wasn't even obviously into the horror realm at that point even. It was just maybe a little bit odd in places.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, and that was too odd for those people, or too off-putting, you know, disturbing. So yeah, Detroit kind of made sense. I guess he thought, hey, go back over here and these people won't have a problem with it. Alice has made remarks over the years about, we were the band that, you know, killed the peace and love generation. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, completely 100% accurate, but, you know, they were definitely one of the bands that kind of put the nail in that coffin at the time too.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't the only, but, you know, they definitely sort of helped within their involvement in California at that time. They definitely would have. But I mean, not completely, because the Doors were around.
That's true.
And, you know, and I think Jim Morrison was just as responsible for that as Alice Cooper would have been. Jim Morrison was not necessary peace and love vibes. I mean, they might have had those moments on some of their songs, but then some of their songs are particularly dark, and his stage presence might have been more confrontational even than Alice's.
That's true, yeah.
You know, like, and talk about a guy who wanted to start shit, you know, who wanted shit to go down when the gigs were happening. I mean, so, in a lot of ways, you know, Alice is listed as sort of like the godfather of punk in some ways, in the same way that Iggy Pop is and various other people. But I think in some ways Jim Morrison kind of fit in that too. Like, he was a shit disturber, you know, and if he could cause some shit and get the police to, like, start pounding people, he considered it a good night. You know?
Like,
so, I mean, yeah, I think in a lot of ways Jim Morrison was that kind of an asshole as well, too, who just wanted to start trouble, because it excited him to see that kind of action happening. And also, there was a lot of dark vibes on Doors records, too, right from the very beginning. I mean, what is the end other than just like a miserably kind of dark song all around, you know?
That's true, yeah.
And then there's a lot of that through the Doors music as well. But now I'm getting off on a whole other tangent. The Doors. But yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah,
I
do believe Alice had a part in that, you know, the killing the peace and love era, you know, I believe they definitely had a part in that, but I just think there was others as well, you know, but yeah, so anyways, they move off to Detroit, and that's when things start to go good, definitely. Love It to Death was obviously the first real sign of life, because radio embraced 18.
That's right.
You know, it wasn't just radio in Detroit. Other markets were beginning to play the song, and it was like, aha, okay, so now you got Ohio and places like that beginning to play it, and, you know, Cleveland's picked it up, and it's getting picked up in Toronto, and it's getting picked up in these different markets, and it's building the, you know, the name brand. People are hearing about this thing. mm-hmm. the Alice Cooper group. And yeah, and that album also solidified a style that they would stick with, and a style that was going to be way more appealing to more people. I think it's still one of the better records.
Yeah, it's a great album, yeah.
I mean, you just think of, like, some songs I already mentioned, whether it's 18 or Caught in a Dream or Long Way to Go or How'd Be My Name or Ballad of Dwight Fry, these are all, like, classics. I mean, mm-hmm. most of that record is solid. So, yeah, an exceptional record, definitely. And it only went up from there. I mean, this is at a time period, too, you know, where bands were putting out sometimes two studio albums in a year, and touring as well.
Yeah.
So in 71, Alice Cooper released both Love It to Death and Killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then Killer, again, look at the track list. I mean, some of the songs on there. I mean, you get things like Under My Wheels and Desperado, you know, and Dead Babies, and You Drive Me Nervous, and all these songs like that are great songs. I got to say, I mean, people love it. I never really loved Black Juju that much.
Oh, you didn't?
It drags on for too goddamn long for me.
Yeah, it does. It does kind of go on, yeah.
I mean, it's cool in a live setting. If you watch live footage of that time and you see him perform the song, I mean, there's more theater to it with the whole midsection and the bodies need rest kind of segment and all that. But, I mean, still, it's a little long-winded for me.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting enough, I saw Lydia Lunch perform that song once, too.
Oh, did you? Where?
Yeah, in Toronto. She'd come back to do a Toronto show. Oh my God, one of the first shows she did music in Toronto in a lot of years. Maybe this was 10 years ago. And yeah, and she played Black Juju. And
wow.
I was like, oh, this is cool. Because I think she had previously covered it on an album, which was a tribute to Alice. But yeah, I was surprised when it made the set list. I was like, oh, wow. You know, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
And, you know, she did the same way, though. It was long and plotted out. So, you know, but, you know, what are you going to do? I guess that's the way you got to play that song.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so, and I feel that same sort of way about Halo of Flies, too, that it's a little long and plotted out. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
these are just personal tastes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and so, I mean, needless to say, the Killer Tour was huge. The Killer Tour was when he really got out there, and they really started to develop the theatrics. That's when they first introduced, you know, the hanging and all that. I mean, well, original pressings of the album were a gatefold, right? I don't know if you know, it had the calendar.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The year in there, and there's the shot of him hanging from the noose. And that was only in, I think, the earliest editions of the record. But, I mean, that was the highlight of the show. People hadn't seen things like that before. So now here's a guy on stage getting hung, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was enticing to people. And, you know, Killer is a pretty cool record. And some of the songs, like the song Killer, which, again, is another long plotting song, so that kind of goes nowhere. But, you know, and Dead Babies, for that matter, is also pretty long and slow and plotting. But I do like Dead Babies because the lyrics really kind of, you know, bring that song up to a different level.
Yeah.
They're pretty amazing. So.
Well, if you're going to talk about taboos, you know, that's
exactly.
a pretty big one. And Killer was the second album produced by Ezrin, right? Bob Ezrin.
Yes. Yeah, he did Love It to Death before that. Yeah.
And we should mention Bob Ezrin because he's pretty instrumental in the whole, you know, Alice Cooper trajectory.
Yeah, for sure.
Like,
he
ended up producing something like 11 Alice Cooper, like, solo and band albums, right?
Yeah.
And
a lot of that work was done out of Toronto, too. I mean, not all the work, because a lot of those albums were done in other areas as well, of the States for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But because Ezrin was Toronto-based, there would always be some studio work done in Toronto, and then maybe they'd finish up in LA and New York or whatever too. But yeah, you know, so yeah, there was a Toronto connection to a lot of the records too.
Mm-hmm.
And but not those early ones.
Not the early ones, no.
But the Death and Killer were done in the States. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Welcome to My Nightmare that they started doing some Toronto recording.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah.
It continued on from there even, too, for a few things here and there. But yeah, Killer was the first real big break. Killer, I think, was the jump to, like, hockey arenas kind of thing.
That's right.
That's when it broke. And then, you know, then in 72, there was only one album, but Schools Out was a huge one. And probably the first big radio hit he had with the title track.
Yeah,
I mean, that was obviously a big radio song. And, you know, I don't know if it's considered to most people more of a classic than 18. Probably is, actually.
It probably is, because it's inherently interesting. I mean, what kid did not grow up loving Schools Out, you know?
Yeah. I know.
I mean, it was an anthem.
It's probably one
of
his most iconic songs of the career, which is probably why it's always been in pretty much every show he's probably ever played. But that's probably true of 18 as well. You know?
Yeah, probably is. And in terms of, like, Alice Cooper is a master of marketing, too. Like, his albums had some amazing gimmicks. And
yeah.
Schools Out had, you know, the fold-out vinyl where you could, you know, create a school desk,
right? Yeah, the desk. Yeah. And, of course, it also had the panties.
And the panties, yeah. I've never seen one with the panties other than
hard to find,
you know, online. Yeah.
I've never had it either. Yeah. I know, it's crazy. Although, I got to say, though, as an album, I don't particularly think Schools Out is a masterpiece of his records. I think that one was definitely a lesser record than Love It to Death and Killer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a few other good songs on it. I mean, I think Looney Tunes is a great song, and I think Public Animal Number 9 is a great song. But a lot of the stuff on that record, I don't know. I mean, I think they're beginning to experiment a little bit more, and some of the stuff just,
mm-hmm.
yeah, didn't really work for me.
Yeah.
Whereas 1973... again, brought a year with two albums, Billion Dollar Babies, and then followed up by Muscle of Love.
Yep.
Muscle of Love would be the last album with the original group, but Billion Dollar Babies, I think, is probably more to the level of Love It to Death and Killer. I think it's a pretty solid album.
It is, yeah. I love that album.
I mean, the title cut is amazing.
Yeah.
Hello Hooray,
Hello
Elected.
Hooray is great, yeah. Dorm's Elected is
nice
such
guy.
A great song. Yeah, I mean, it's one solid song after another.
And then you get the doom horror type songs too, like Sick Things and I Love the Dead,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Rape and Freezing is another sort of Stonesy type of thing. But I mean, it's just a solid record in the way that Love It to Death and Killer were more solid records. But Muscle of Love is the opposite of that.
It is.
Muscle of Love has the title song, and it's got Teenage Lament 74. But beyond that, it's kind of like, yeah, there's a couple songs that are okay, like Big Apple Dreaming. But for the most part, it's not a great record.
No. And I mean, by the time Muscle...
showing the cracks.
By the time Muscle of Love came out, I was firmly an Alice Cooper fan, you know? And
yeah.
And Muscle of Love, I was really looking forward to. And it came out with, again, the packaging was great.
Yeah.
It was a cardboard box with Muscle of Love on it, which is so hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, I took it home and I listened to it, and I maybe listened to it a couple of times and just thought, okay, that
yeah,
one was
yeah.
just okay. Which is too bad because it was the final album by that lineup.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Although so. I got to say, in terms of packaging, I think my favorite album of all the Alice Cooper, of the original Alice Cooper Group albums, is Billion Dollar Babies.
Yeah, that's great.
I love the look of the wallet. Has, you know, the original copies had the rounded wallet for the corners too, which later copies did not have the rounded corners.
Yeah.
The packaging inside was unbelievable. I mean, because, you know, you would open it up and the original copies had like the billfold for a wallet, and that's where the giant dollar bill was.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, it wasn't a dollar bill. What was the bill?
It was a billion dollar.
A billion dollar bill, exactly. Yeah. And, I still have that because over the years I'd found copies in thrift stores that actually had all the stuff in them.
Really?
Often the records would be trashed, but I couldn't believe that the stuff was in there. Because besides the bill, that record also had a really cool insert sheet, which had lyrics, and a really cool color photo of them where Alice is holding the baby, and there's bills there were swords, you know, going through the bills attached, you know, just things like that. But, and then also there was, in the gatefold, there was cutout cards. You could push them out of the cover.
Oh, yeah.
They were like perforated, so you could push them out, and there was like nine cards.
Right.
And and they were very cool. So that's the album I look at where I just think the packaging was amazing. I love the wallet gimmick. I love the bill inside. You know, the photos were great. The trading cards that you could cut out of the thing. I mean, it was just amazing packaging, and also a great album too on top of it. So
yeah, that's true.
It might be the one I look at as the peak album of the Alice Cooper Group era.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And I think I said I bought Muscle Love when it first came out, but I didn't. I was a fan, and I picked it up after the fact because I kind of like grabbed the other ones first, and Welcome to My Nightmare was my first album that I bought.
Yeah, because you would have been 9 when Muscle Love
came. I purchased that, you know, a couple of years later.
And now, since Muscle of Love was the last album with the original band, the thing you got to wonder there was, like, I don't know what was going on behind the scenes there, you know, creating problems. Like, maybe management for Alice was saying that you should be a solo act, and he was beginning to think it was a good idea, and maybe the rest of the guys were getting kind of, like, concerned that this is the way it was going to go. But something just didn't gel on that record. So my guess is that they probably weren't getting along the greats at that time, so the songwriting was not the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like a lot of the stuff on that record is just kind of like thrown together, like we got to do an album. You know, it's like, actually, and maybe it wasn't the best time for them all as people even.
Yeah, in the documentary Super Duper Alice Cooper, they talk about that, and they said that, you know, because they were releasing album after album and touring incessantly, there was really not much of a break, is that they were all just kind of getting pretty tired of doing all this stuff. Plus, I think there was an element of, at that time, like Alice Cooper, who we think of as Alice Cooper, the person and not the band, was getting the bulk of the attention, you know?
For sure.
And
sure.
So anytime that happens, a band will start to fracture because, you know, they all started
everyone
at the same time. Everyone, and there was even, according to that documentary, talk of releasing solo albums, like Kiss did, and they were told, well, you don't want to do that because no one's going to want any album other than Alice Cooper's album.
Yeah,
you know, like
exactly.
Fournier. Like his record would sell, but none of the other guys would.
No, who wants to buy an album by the bass player?
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't sing. You know, none of these guys sang lead or anything, so it was like it's just, you know, a bunch of dudes who are the band.
Yeah.
I mean, they're crucial in the sense that they're the band, but they're not frontmen in and of their own.
No.
But, of course, they did eventually form a band together, you know, and no one really cared about it either.
Yeah, so they released one album, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't meant to be, and obviously that was the end. But it took Alice 2 more years, basically, to get Welcome to My Nightmare actually put together. But, you know, that was a big production.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because, I mean, now he's not working with a band per se. He's just working with studio guys so they can bring in the best of the best, whatever they can find. Mm-hmm. And obviously Bob Ezrin has the connections. He knows studio musicians. That's why there's even a lot of Toronto content on that record. I mean, some of the guys were people they brought over from Detroit, like the guitarist Steve Hunter and Dick Wagner. But then some of those dudes, especially the rhythm section, were all Toronto-based guys. They did a lot of session work and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they ended up doing the tour as well afterwards. But they're, you know, that's, again, more of the Toronto content comes in.
Yeah.
But Welcome to My Nightmare is definitely, in terms of production, way more out there than the previous records.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fuller sounding record. There's much more diversity of sounds. The professionalism is there in a way that it maybe isn't on their other records, because the other records represent a real organic band, and that record represents, let's just bring in who we need to do these parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so it definitely has a very different feel about it. Ultimately, I don't think that's a bad thing. It's a different thing, but I think it makes that record stand out differently than the previous records. I mean, it's as a conceptual piece, too, it has a different feel to it. It's a story.
It is, yeah.
And that gives you a different appreciation for it as an entirety, whereas there are things you could take as separate songs. This thing is meant to be a story. And I think the added professionalism of the performances of the songs actually enhances it, makes it better.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems more cinematic. It seems larger. And I don't know if that would have happened with the previous band. If those songs were attempted by the band, I think there would be elements of maybe a little more rawness there that might enhance some things, but would also detract from other things.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to have, you know, to see what the band would have done with that material. But
I think songs like Devil's Food and the Black Widow would work, and Cold Ethel, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even Department of Youth and Escape to a certain degree, but songs like Steven would be a problem. Only Women Bleed, I think they could handle that in a more streamlined version.
Yeah, but even the title song, Welcome to My Nightmare, would have
different,
been
very different, because
yeah.
It's got a funkier vibe that they didn't have. And mm-hmm. then you get a song like Some Folks, which is basically the show tune aspects, which they would not have been able to do.
Yeah, and there's horns on it, and, you know,
yeah.
like strings and all kinds of stuff, you know. And it's much more it's much more theatrical and almost vaudevillian at times, you know.
Well, definitely Some Folks is that.
Yeah, yeah.
Some folks love to see red. Some folks never talk about it. Some folks crave a blue lady. Some folks know, still they doubt it. I'm just no good without it. I'm not a man at all. It makes my skin crawl.
And it plays a part in his live performances too. I mean, his live performances are very vaudevillian in a lot of ways. I mean, many times he almost seems like a wannabe song and dance man, you know?
Sure, sure. I know, but in terms of the horror aspects of that record, I think it also works better than the previous attempts at the more horror aspects, because Devil's Food, Black Widow, you know, is a great piece, but then it's made even better by Vincent Price being on it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, which adds an element to it. But even a song like Steven, you know, has a creepier vibe than any of the songs he'd done before in that horror vein, because now he's doing this voice of the character as a child and everything, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has a much creepier vibe to it. So
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it was just much more effective as a conceptual piece with horror elements than the horror elements that appeared in the earlier songs on earlier records. Ballad of Dwight Fry is an early attempt at what would later appear on Welcome to My Nightmare in terms of songs like Steven. You know, it was the same kind of idea, but it wasn't as executed as professionally and slickly as it was on Welcome to My Nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to see you go. I don't even want to be there. I will cover up my eyes and pray it goes away. You only lived a minute of your life. I must be dreaming. Please stop screaming.
To hear you cry, you just don't know how deep that cuts me.
So I will cover up my eyes, and it will go. only lived a minute of your life. I must be dreaming, please stop screaming.
You know, it's definitely a solid record, and it's not for nothing that, you know, the follow-up tour would be like the biggie at that point in time in his career. Like, this was the tour now where the stage show is going to be insane, and, you know, I mean, the record's doing really well, so that every show is going to be a sellout in all these bigger venues, and, you know, that was the peak. So it was smart that they documented as well as they did with the concert film and with the shot in Toronto TV special.
Yeah.
You know, because the TV special, The Nightmare, in a lot of ways is more interesting to me than the concert film.
Because
the concert film's cool. Here's what the live show looked like when you went to see it.
The concert film is much slicker, and I mean, it's meant for a theatrical release, right?
True, but in some ways, I think because it's a concert film, I think there's something about that actually makes it almost more easy to relate to, because anyone who's been to a concert and seen a concert film says, yeah, it's just like watching with closer up camera angles and things and your perspective as an audience member. But the thing about the TV show that I thought was more effective than the stage show is that the TV show can use sets and studios and lighting and things like that to create the mood. And I think it adds an element of like oddness and eeriness to some of that you didn't really get in the movie.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
A stage show is a stage show. It's like going on stage and doing a play. You can have, you know, the giant tooth chase you around or things like that.
Yeah.
But it's not the same thing as the vibe you can create in the studio set, you know, with dancers behind you that are, you know, and just, yeah, the look of a studio set is different than the look of a stage.
Mm-hmm. And it goes from set to set, you know?
It does. It changes.
So, yeah.
And that's something that you have a harder time doing in the context of a live show.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the stage is going to be basically the same. The band is going to be the backdrop still. They're still going to be there, you know what I mean? So, but they can change the motif of each song, really, if they want to, with the TV show. And that's what I really like about the special. The special also has a look of, like, I don't know if it's just the look of the way they shot things at the time, but there's an element of cheapness to it that almost looks like video.
Yeah.
Maybe it was. I think
it was, from what I remember. Yeah. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it seemed, I seem to remember it as that.
It also seems oddly like low-budget Canadian, too, in some ways.
It seems like
the kind of thing that was common in Canadian productions, but it actually kind of worked in its favor. It gave it the sort of chintziness that kind of added to, I don't know, some of the ridiculousness of the whole story and the theme and what they were trying to put together. I don't know. It really worked for me. It was very successful for me that way.
Mm-hmm.
More so than the movie. And I mean, I like the concert film, but there's something about the nightmare that just is, it's just kind of entertaining to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun.
It is.
And I mean, there's even, I mean, really it's just the album, but there is even a track or two from earlier material. The Ballad of Dwight Fry is thrown into it as well. Whereas obviously in the context of the concert film, it does represent other stages of the career. So there's more material from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the TV show obviously wasn't meant to be as long as the concert film. So it really focuses more on the record itself of Well Into My Nightmare and not really so much on the back catalog, with the exception, like I said, of Ballad of Dwight Fry.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was pretty excellent. And definitely marked a turning point in Alice Cooper's career. I'm sure the guys who were no longer in the group were just watching this rise happen and thinking, God damn it. You know? Or probably just hoping that he fails.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, just like, fuck this guy.
Yeah, let's just get back together and do what we did before. But it just got bigger and bigger for him.
Yeah.
You know.
Although the interesting thing, though, to consider, though, is that, yeah, from what we're saying right now, the rise was noticeable and huge, but the problem was that the follow-up to that didn't quite muster up.
Okay, well, we hope you're liking the first part of our look into Alice Cooper. a favorite of both mine and Glenn's. I'm having a lot of fun putting it together and reminiscing and listening to Alice's great tunes. We hope you tune in to the next part, which is Life Beyond the Nightmare of Alice Cooper. And there's some great stuff, some controversial albums that fans generally don't like, but me and Glenn really do, and lots, lots more. Thanks again for listening. Become a patron if you can. Buy stuff from suspectvideo.ca if you can. And tell your friends if you like the show. Thanks. Alice Cooper, Part 1 has ended. Alice Cooper, Part 2 is coming.
The horror that he'll bring, the horror of his sting, the unholiest of kings, the Black Widow. Our minds will be his toy, and every girl and boy will learn to be employed. The Black Widow.
Thank you for listening. Music is played by Trigger Warning. Check out their Facebook page. Links are in the show notes. A Very Suspect Podcast is copyright Suspect Video. All rights reserved. See you next week.
Words I want to write.